This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana, signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet. Your number is 877-217-5757. Emails to talk at talklouisiana.org. We start with the voice of the Valley, Dan Bornay. He began that gig in 1986, so this will be season number 37. And if I count the coaches, that's Arnsparger, Archer, Holman, DiNardo, Hal Hunter for a game. And then Nick Saban, Les Miles, Ed Orgeron, and Brad Davis for a game. And now Brian Kelly. So that's 10 coaches for Dan Bornay as the voice of the Valley. And he's now held that job longer than Sid Crocker, who was a legendary voice in Baton Rouge, not only at Tiger Stadium, but of course, for many years on WAFB Channel 9. Dan's also been the voice at the Pete Maravich Assembly Center for a number of years, and I forget which came first, but the other night, appropriately, he was perched outside the PMAC when a new statue honoring Pistol Pete, the leading scorer in major college history, 52 years after his last game at LSU, his records still stand, 3,667 points and 44.2 points per game. The Pistol was preeminent. He's now appropriately honored in the back of the arena, along with Shaquille O'Neal and with none other than Bob Pettit. Pettit played in the 50s, Shaq played in the 90s, a little bit of the 80s, and Pistol Pete ruled the roost from 1966 to 1970. He was not eligible as a freshman. Freshmen were not playing on the varsity when Pistol Pete was in uniform as number 23, but there is a statue after all these years. It was in mothballs for several years. The LSU Board of Supervisors approved it in 2016. It took 6 years. And there is a new development. I had some people at Louis this morning saying they went out to see the statue and it has been damaged. Now, I didn't see any damage the other night when it was unveiled, but it is a case in which apparently there is some significant damage to the statue of Pistol Pete, and we'll have to get to the bottom of this, but it could be that somebody desecrated the statue, or it could be it was damaged and nobody noticed, but a couple of gentlemen told me in Louis this morning, Dan Bornay, that Pete's statue has already been damaged. You were there the other night. It looked okay to me. I like the statue, but it would be terrible if somebody took it upon themselves to do damage to the iconic Pistol Pete Maravich. Your thoughts, Dan Bornay?
Well, you can't coach stupid, no matter how hard you try. If you try to coach stupid, it just gets stupider. So I don't know what happened. First I've heard of it, but I hope it's easily correctable. And it was quite a night. It was a wonderful experience to be honored to emcee the event, and having covered Pete for 2 years when he was a junior and senior at LSU, and knowing him and knowing his dad, Press, and having interviewed them, and being there the night he broke the record and covering it for CBS Radio, all that was just a great, a very emotional time. It was great.
And Dan Bornay, to show you what a professional he is, he had no idea what I just said. He just walked in. He was doing his duties as Deacon Dan this morning, and he, as you heard, answered quite cogently and eloquently about Pistol Pete. Now, you were there January 31st, 1971, when he broke Oscar Robertson's record, 1970, 52 years and some change. I gather at that time it was probably thought, somebody will come around in 5 or 6 years and break Pistol's record. Didn't happen.
Didn't happen for a lot of reasons. There was never another Pistol to begin with. I mean, there might have been some slingshots in there, but never a Pistol. He had a unique blend of talent, of dedication, of hard work. All those things came together. And of course, he only played 3 seasons because you couldn't play as a freshman. So he broke a record in 3 seasons. Now coming along, the game has evolved where anyone who would average 44.2 points a game wouldn't stay in the college game very long. That person would be one and out. So I don't think it's ever going to be broken. I think it's the most enduring individual record, I think, in all of sport. If you look at across sports, in every event that's still run are still, you know, in existence. You might have a 220-yard dash, a meter dash, for example, that might have been on a curve at one time. It's now on a straightaway. Those types of things. I can understand how those records might never be broken because the event's not the same. But the event, in terms of just playing basketball and scoring points, I don't think anyone will get close.
All right. Well, Jeff Palermo, the news and sports director for Louisiana Radio Network, says the sculptor that made the statue said on Tiger Rag Radio last night that it was not properly stored and they had to do emergency work and still need to replace the base of the statue and probably will do that when they put up the Simone statue. But Robbie Huey at Louis this morning said he took a close look at it and the shoulders are damaged. And I didn't see that the other night. In fact, I liked the statue. But it is possible that somebody is up to no good, and we've had at least one of the other statues spray-painted on one occasion. But you can get paint off a bronze sculpture. If somebody takes an axe or something like that and starts hacking away, that's a different story. Let's hope that did not happen.
I hope not. So if I was too quick in my assigning stupidity to some person, I apologize.
Well, if somebody did that, yeah. Yeah. But it could be that it was damaged and we just didn't notice it.
Just didn't see it. Right.
But,
you know, you don't really look for details. You sit back and you look at the whole deal. And say, wow.
And another Louis patron, and Louis, by the way, is the center of the universe at about 7 o'clock every morning, said that it is not lighted, that Pettit and Shaq have lights and Pete's in the dark.
All things come to those who stand and wait.
All right, 877-217-5757. And we will talk about what happened 50 years ago. The ubiquitous Dan Bornay was an aide to one other than Alan Joseph Ellender, U.S. Senator from Louisiana for almost 40 years. He died 50 years ago today. But the aforementioned Robbie Huey in Mid-City is calling in. Robbie, good morning. You were one of those in Louis this morning who said that somebody apparently did something to Pete's statue. What does it look like? I wanted to get over there, but I didn't have time.
Well, I'm not really saying anybody did anything. I was a big, huge fan of Pete and used to wait in line 2 hours just to watch him play when he was a freshman. But I walked away just shaking my head because the base, the corners of the back corners of the base of the statue sculpt are missing. They've been chipped away for some unknown reason. There's a huge indentation on the Shaquille O'Neal side. Not huge, but it's noticeable. But it just really upset me to see it in that condition for being new. And, you know, on a good note, I can remember Bob Peters was an announcer back then on the radio network, and they were playing Georgia at Georgia, and right before half, Pete hit a hook shot from half court. And I've never heard Bob Peters so excited in my life.
He did some magical things. He was running out the clock, wasn't he, and just threw up a hook shot.
No, no shot clock. He could dribble all he wanted, and no three-point play. And you
no,
know,
that would have been 3 points, but it was two.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, from half court.
Yeah, right, half court. A hook.
Yeah.
Piece
yeah.
of cake.
I heard that actually was at the end of the game because I read a story, and of course I was living in another state at that time as a young lad in Little Rock. I didn't get the full exposure to Pete, but they carried him off the court in Georgia. He was iconic with the visitors.
You know, a lot of these stories, they gain a lot of, you know, stuff over the years, but some things you just can't get away from, and that watching Pete Maravich play basketball live in that Cow Palace, it was magical. It truly, truly was.
John in Broadmoor. John, you're on with Dan. Good morning, John.
Good morning, gentlemen. My father told me a story many years ago. On his daily commute, he would pass by the Maravich house, and he said one time it was a pretty good thunderstorm going on, and Pete was out there practicing in the driveway, his routine. Dan mentioned his dedication and work ethic. My question is...
Well, hold on for just a second. Just a second, John. Sure. Barbara Clark asked me the other day where Pete lived, and I didn't know. Do you know where he lived in Baton Rouge?
I don't know. Yeah, I think it must be somewhere in the area of Choctaw, the original home, because that's where my father worked on old Choctaw Drive.
Really? And of course, Choctaw was... a prestige address in those days. But anyway, what was your question?
Well, I think in Pete's case, he loved the game, but I see sometimes young athletes these days that are being pushed so hard by their parents, and they're trying to please their parents, and maybe sometimes they don't love the game as much as they love their parents. So just kind of wonder about your thought and Dan's thoughts on that.
All right, Dan.
Well, I can only speak to Pete. He's the one that I knew and watched, and his dedication was just beyond compare. And it went on even after his career at LSU. Of course, went into the pros and had a remarkable professional career. It's in the all the Hall of Fames you can get into. And then beyond that, he coached. And he when I say he coached, he had camps, and he put out videotapes. People might remember videotapes, but they're videotapes of Pete teaching, dribbling, passing, shooting.
877-217-5757, back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We'll spend a few more minutes on the legendary Pistol Pete Maravich, George Morris, who grew up in South Carolina, where they played some pretty good basketball under Frank McGuire. He said it not so long ago on this show that Pete Maravich was the greatest college basketball player of all time. And when we put into context that there was no shot clock and no three-point play, yes, his shooting percentage was 43.8, but I looked, in those days, shooting percentages weren't what they were today. Bob Pettit, by the way, 46% from the field, and he was an inside player.
Yeah.
So the game has changed in that regard, and Pete's 43.8 was actually pretty good. And, of course, we knew he was shooting like crazy, and he had the green light from his father.
That's right. And the rest of the guys, you know, they were a great supporting cast, but they were a supporting cast.
They were.
That was it.
And they were okay with that.
Sure they were.
They were in his orbit.
I mean, who wouldn't, who in his galaxy? I mean, who wouldn't enjoy playing with a guy who could you know, fake everybody out on the court and in the stands?
Mm-hmm. Well, in Press Maravich, the coach who brought Pete with him in 1966, he left North Carolina State to come to LSU. Think about that. After he left North Carolina State, the predecessor, Norm Sloan, won a national title. And then Sloan's, the successor, Norm Sloan, won a title. And then his successor, Jim Valvano, won one. So there you go. He left a good job to come to LSU, and thank God he brought Pete Maravich with him. But he owned three Maryland Fried Chicken franchises in Baton Rouge, one on Plank Road, one on State Street, and the other one... someone will have to call and tell me where it was, but
that is a masterful piece of trivia.
Yeah, yeah. Tim and Thibodeau. Tim, good morning. You're on with Dan. Hi, Tim.
Thanks a lot, Dan, and thanks a lot, Jim. Listen, I just want to know one misstatement. He's not in every Hall of Fame. He's not in the LSU Athletic Hall of Fame.
That is correct.
Why not? I do understand that some have said he didn't receive a degree. Well, I knew him. And I helped him at Broussard Hall and everything. He was smart as all get out. And Dan knows that as well. The thing about it is, I hate to see this be a political ball for any reason.
Well, they have a committee that determines who goes before the board, and they rubber stamp the people who are in the Hall of Fame. There are four non-graduates in the Hall, and Pete would be the fifth. So it's not unprecedented, and now we've got guys like the Honey Badger and Patrick Peterson who have given millions to LSU and were worthy players, as we know. What are they going to do about them? But there is apparently one member of that committee, it has to be a unanimous vote, who is blocking Pistol Pete. And, Dan, that's unfortunate.
Well, Tim, your old teacher and my old teacher, Sarah Shufelt, would have corrected me. I should have said he's in every other Hall of Fame.
Except the one
every other
that
one
is in the Pete Maravich
right.
Assembly Center.
He's got a statue, and sometimes success, speaks for itself.
He'll get there, but hopefully it'll be when you and I are alive.
So, Tim bequeathed to me at Thibodaux High School when he graduated. He bequeathed to me his job as a statistician for the Thibodaux mm-hmm. High football team. And it's because of that mm-hmm. that I became involved in athletics. It's because of that that I began writing the stories for the Thibodaux paper, for the Thibodaux High football games, because he gave me that job when he graduated and went on to LSU. And Tim, I'll never forget, Mr. Silverberg called me when he realized that you had bequeathed that job to me, And he said, Danny, I'd like you to write the stories of the Thibodaux High football games for the paper. And I said, I don't know how to write a story about a football game. And Jim and Tim, he gave me the best advice I ever got. He says, it's very simple. He said, first you tell the score, and then you tell how it got that way. And you know, that's been something that stuck with me forever. Thanks, Tim. Great hearing from you.
Thanks, Tim. And Tom on Bluebonnet says the third location of Press Maravich's Maryland Fried Chicken was in the old Rebel Shopping Center on Florida Boulevard. And Lester Duway says my sisters used to get that chicken in LSU days. Apparently it's a pretty good chicken.
Well,
so we had Colonel Sanders and we had Press Maravich. KC in Mid-City. KC, you're on with Dan.
Hey, greetings, gentlemen. Thank you all for this piece. And I just wanted to see if either of you could kind of speak about Pete's actions off the court. I'm the founder of the Walls Project, and I still have a picture of Pete Maravich and I from when I was in fifth grade, and I was actually one of the Tiger Tykes in his instructional basketball videos. He was my first mentor. And the first time I went to his basketball camp in Clearwater, I got a concussion, and he sat up with me all night in the dorm. And from that point forward, he was a mentor, and he did so much off the court. I would love for y'all to talk about his greatness beyond basketball.
Well, he was an evangelist of sorts. Of course, he was an evangelist in basketball, and of course, he was an evangelist of the gospel as well, because he became a Christian. He had some substance abuse issues that he actually dealt with straight up in his book, his autobiography, not a one written about him, but his, called Heir to a Dream. I recommend it for everyone. And he was helping Focus on the Family when he died in California. He was playing a pickup game with Dr. Jim Dobson and helping in that ministry. Mm-hmm. And that's when he died. So Pete died where he lived to be, on a basketball court.
January 5th, 1988. He was 40 years old. He's been gone now for 34 and a half years. And he left quite a mark at LSU. And the irony was that the press's predecessor at LSU, Frank Truitt, only coached there 1 year, and he left because the athletic director at the time, Jim Corbett, would not allow him to recruit black players. And that was a tragedy, but look what happened. Press Maravich comes in, and he brings Pete with him, and within a few years, he brought Collis Temple.
Collis Temple, yeah, right.
That began
the legacy of, well, it began the Temple legacy in basketball with with CT3 and with Garrett, but others as well.
Well, and when we first invited Dan on this show, it was before the announcement that Pete's statue was even going to be put in place outside the PMAC, but it was to remember his former boss, Alan Joseph Ellender, politician, lawyer, a man from Dan's neck of the woods who had an immense legacy in the U.S. Senate and was the last man with Huey Pierce Long when the Kingfish was shot in 1935. And to put it in perspective, for a few months, Rose McConnell Long was the U.S. Senator. Then it was Alan Ellender for almost 40 years. Then it was Bennett Johnston for 24. And then it was Mary Landrieu for 18. And then we had Bill Cassidy in there now, 8 years. And a listener notes, we've got a smart audience, that Elaine Edwards was briefly the U.S. Senator. So all three women who have represented Louisiana in the Senate, Elaine, when Ellender died, for a few months. So, yeah. But Rose, Elaine, and Mary, the three. But Alan Ellender, he was a man of his time. He was a segregationist. But we're going to hear something in a few moments, Dan, that our producer Robin Dow found. Alan Ellender talking with Lyndon Johnson and asking him to stop Vietnam in 1964. He was certainly, he was right about that, and Lyndon should have listened to it.
Well, he was not reticent about talking to the staff about it either, because I worked for him in Washington. Went up in March of 71 and was working for him when he died in July of 72. And he was an adamant anti-Vietnam War guy. J. William Fulbright was also a Democrat who was anti-war, and Ellender was very, very seriously concerned about getting involved deeply in Indochina, then in the Far East.
But they were in a minority, they were two Democrats from the South, which, right, of course, is a hawkish part of the country. But J. William Fulbright, and Alan Ellender both were right about Vietnam, and Lyndon Johnson, unfortunately, was wrong. And when we return from the break, we'll hear from that. But the civil rights activities of senators from the South, the Southern Manifesto, which would have undone Brown versus Board of Education, it was signed by all the senators from the South except Lyndon Johnson and Albert Gore. There might have been another one, but I think that was it. Johnson and Gore, everyone signed it, and they did so because they supposedly had to. They supposedly had to.
Well, they had it's hard to use today's moral standards to judge people's actions 50, 60, 70 years ago. It's not to justify the actions, but they reflected the public opinion of the time and the people that they represented. Now, as we look back, they might have been on the right side of politics, mm-hmm. but they were on the wrong side of history, especially when it came to civil rights.
And we'll return with Dan Bornay on Alan Ellender and more when we come back after this. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Alan Joseph Ellender, he died on this date, July 27, 1972, 50 years ago today, right after Watergate. He was a conservative from the South, a Democrat. Today, he quite possibly would be a Republican, probably would. But on issues of war and peace, he was not the hawkish person that many in the South and the rest of the country, for that matter, were at that time. And he advised Lyndon Baines Johnson, who was president of the United States at the time, to do away with the Vietnam effort. Now, he had a conversation with Lyndon Johnson a few days after the 1964 presidential election. Now, Johnson won 44 states, a landslide that no Democrat has replicated, November 3, 1964. But one of the states he lost was Louisiana. And in Louisiana and other southern states, the civil rights stance by Lyndon Johnson was poison. His running mate, of course, was Hubert Humphrey, graduate of LSU. I'm just showing you. Dan, here's the state of Mississippi, how it looked. Every county in Mississippi went for one Barry Goldwater in 1964. This was a harbinger of things to come. And in Louisiana, Johnson got 43% and Goldwater got 57%. And, of course, it was an extremely uncomfortable conversation when Alan Ellender basically was calling to congratulate the president and had to acknowledge that his state didn't go for him. And you can hear him. He's trying to explain why this did not happen. Let's give Senator Ellender a listen. Here he was 5 days after LBJ won a landslide but got clobbered in Louisiana. And Vietnam does come up in this conversation.
Hello?
Hello?
Hello, Alan.
Hello, how's the toothache?
I'm doing pretty good, pretty good.
I found this morning's paper that you had a toothache.
Oh, I just had a little filling came out.
Uh-huh. Well, I tried to get you the other day, and all the lines were busy, and I abandoned it.
Well, I've been...
I've been very busy going over the state.
Yeah?
And I'm proud to say that our section of the country went well for you, except I was disappointed in New Orleans.
Yeah?
You know, in 60,000 votes, you topped Goldwater by only barely 1,000 votes.
I'll be darned.
In my own parish, Terrebonne, we topped that two times as much.
Well, I'll be darned.
The third district went for you almost your national average. That's where I live.
That's good. Well, that's wonderful, Alan. I'm sure glad. I didn't know how the state broke.
I tell you, that northern part, as well as the Florida parishes, you know, the Negro question was dominant.
That's right. And I can understand it. I knew it was awfully near impossible.
But I was really disappointed in Orleans Parish, where I talked to Boggs the day before the election. He said everything was hunky-dory, but it didn't turn out that way.
Yeah.
I don't know what caused it.
Well, we'll just have to work on them.
Well, I hope that you take a good rest and that you don't rush yourself into more work until January.
I'm not. I'm going to take it a little easy.
I wish you would.
I'm going to take it a little easy, my friend.
If there's anything I could do to give assistance on your foreign policy, I'd like to talk to you sometime about it. And,
all right. We'll sit down.
This business is pretty rough.
Yeah, we'll sit down. What do you think we ought to do in Vietnam?
Well, if it were left to me, as I said on many occasions, it's my belief that this is more of a civil war than anything else. It has been that way for the past 7-8 years. And there were a lot of dissidents that grew up there, and in my estimation, DM, of course, didn't try to take care of those two pockets that gave us the great trouble we had later. Now, of course, I've got all my reports, Lyndon. I'd like to go with it over you personally when I have a chance.
All right.
Before anything is done there, because it's going to be another Second Korea, you know, and our army people tell us we can't get out of there now. We've got to stay there, and we're spending quite a bit of money there, as you know, and sustaining two divisions there, and if we don't mind out, we'll have another Second Korea in South Vietnam.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, and another thing, Lyndon, is the strike. I noticed where Rusk is in Western Europe with the NATO. I believe we've been a little too liberal there, and we ought to try to make our allies a little more conscious of what they ought to do before we go any further.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, those are things I don't want to bother with them now, but I've studied that carefully. I've been on the ground. I know what I'm talking about, I think. And as I told you 2-3 times, I think we have entirely too many military missions abroad. These military missions, you know, keep things stirred up, and it's my belief that you could save money there and help out a lot.
All right,
so there we go. Lyndon Johnson listening, but he didn't follow through with what Senator Ellender was telling him, and as history has proved, Ellender was right.
Yes, and Ellender continued that position. Of course, he also continued to support the troops when he had to, once those big commitments had been made. But he was vocal in his opposition.
September 24, 1890 to July 27, 1972, when he was running for re-election at the time of his death. He was 81 years old, which at that time was a long life. Was this an unexpected departure from the world?
Totally. He was in terrific shape, as a matter of fact. He worked out every day. In fact, he, a white Democrat, segregationist, one of his best friends in the Senate was a black Republican from Massachusetts.
Edward Brooke.
They worked out together in the Senate gym. They were the collegiality was there that you'd never find today. But the 26th or on the 27th, he experienced some pains, flew up to Bethesda, and died at Bethesda on the 27th. In fact, 1972, Jim, was a huge year in Louisiana politics. Edwin Edwards was inaugurated in May of that year. That's when we had inaugurations.
May 9th, yep.
Less than 3 months later, Senator Ellender, chairman of the Appropriations Committee, President Pro Tem of the Senate, ranking mm-hmm. member of Agriculture, died. Edwards was faced with having to appoint an interim senator, and then made sure J. Bennett Johnston won the election. Bennett Johnson became the senator in early November 1972, and the last week of December, Hale Boggs, traveling.
It was actually in October.
In October, the plane went down, and so we lost the majority leader of the House and the chairman of the Appropriations Committee during that tumultuous year.
It was a remarkable year, and it was the year of Watergate. Now, Elaine was the interim senator.
Right.
And
she was appointed the day after Ellender's funeral.
Well, and Dale Thorne, who was Edwards' press secretary, told me a story that I don't know that I've repeated, and Dale's long gone now. He's been gone, unfortunately, for 8 years. But he said that Elaine said she wasn't going to leave, that she was going to stay, and that would deprive Bennett of getting some seniority on others elected. And
she did. I was working for her at the time, and she confided in me. Why should I have to resign?
Well,
because she liked what she was doing, but she did.
Well, according to Dale Thorne, Edwin Edwards raised $25,000 that he brought to Washington in cash and gave it to Elaine Edwards to resign early, and she did.
Well, now that's something I wasn't privy to. Better than I was not. But what happened was, it was fortuitous for the state because Bennett went into the Senate in November, which gave him a leg up seniority-wise on the class of 72, which, by the way, included a freshman senator from Delaware by the name of Joe Biden.
who was elected at 29 and had to wait like Russell Long until he turned 30 to take office. And, and another listener notes that 1972 also brought us John Berlinger Brough, who was elected as the successor to Edwin Edwards in Congress.
Yeah, John worked for Edwin in the 7th District when Edwin was a congressman. And, of course, when Edwin became governor, that seat became open, and John ran for it and won it.
All right. Well, Ellender had an amazing life. He actually had a draft deferment for World War I. He was rejected on grounds with kidney issues, but he still fought to go in and actually served in the U.S. Marine Corps in World War I. Now, there's a man. And he was at the side of one Huey Pierce Long on September 8, 1935. You know that story. He probably told it to you.
He was presiding over the Louisiana legislature. He was a speaker of the Louisiana House. And the last picture of Huey is the picture of Huey talking with Senator Ellender. Now, Ellender, I don't think, was walking with Huey when Huey was shot. He was continuing to preside over the Louisiana House.
The last photo, though.
Last photo, absolutely. Last photo of Huey Long alive was with Senator Ellender.
Who succeeded him.
That's right.
Kind of. But McConnell also was, Rose McConnell Long was a senator for a brief.
Well, in her case, of course, she was the widow of the late Senator Huey Long, and Elaine was Edwin's wife because Senator Ellender had been widowed. He was a widower. He did not have a wife at the time of his death.
Now, Albert Lee Guillory, who was thrown out of Southern University for writing an editorial critical of one Allen Ellender, says even a broken clock is right twice a day. But as we know, senators played hardball in those days. You didn't buck a guy who's been in the Senate for a while. And by that time, Ellender was a legendary figure. And he was a guy who, Speaker of the House and then chair of, which committee was it?
He was chairman of appropriations for years. For agriculture for years.
For agriculture.
And then when the Richard Russell, the chairman of appropriations, died, Ellender took appropriations and stayed on agriculture. Yeah,
and he was a young man when Huey was killed. We're talking 1935, so that's 86 years, almost 87 years ago, and he was born in 1890. So yeah, I guess
45 years old.
Yeah.
And by the way, Albert Guillory, kudos to you. I followed your career and have great respect for
you. Well, and then he took a brave stand as a student at Southern University, but I can understand the elders at Southern at that time didn't want to pick a fight with one Allen Ellender. And Albert lost, but he came back. He survived, and he expressed his point of view, and we're glad for that. And we'll return with more Talk Louisiana after this. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. On deck is the remarkable Deborah Sternberg, but we're wrapping it up with Dan Bornay, who is an aide to Allen Ellender, Senator of Louisiana, U.S. Senator, died 50 years ago today. This will probably be the only place where his death is acknowledged, but Dan, as you note, and a few listeners have, when he died, the president and the vice president of the United States came to his funeral in Houma, didn't they?
The president, the first lady, the vice president, I think we had over 30 senators. It was quite an event, and planned it with the White House advance team and then with the Secret Service, handled the media. So it was quite an event, 50 years ago at St. Francis de Sales Church. And Archbishop Philip Hannon, who himself was a noted veteran,
legendary
of World War
figure.
II, he was the celebrant. Yeah.
And another listener asked a question, and I think I know the answer, but I was a kid and I was living in Arkansas. Bennett Johnston was already in that race, wasn't he?
Yeah, Bennett Johnston had declared coming out of the governor's race because he's very popular. Everybody liked Bennett. He didn't win for governor. He lost by about 5,000 votes.
4,422 votes.
Yeah, so he was riding a wave of popularity. So he was running against Ellender, and Ellender, most people would more or less they would say that Ellender was probably going to win that race. But when Ellender died, Edwin made sure that the qualifications were not reopened, because Edwin had made a commitment to Bennett that if anything happened to Senator Ellender, that Edwin would support Bennett for the U.S. Senate. He wasn't supporting him running against Ellender, but if Ellender were to die or leave office.
And that's exactly what happened.
And
Edwin, whatever you have to say about him politically, he was a man of his word.
He was a man of his word. McKiffin ended up running as an independent. Yeah, and
got clobbered.
Toledano ran and Lyons ran. There were like a bunch of people in the race. Bennett got over 55% of the vote. So,
all right, and he won again and again and again. Last time though, he got 54% against a guy named David Duke, and that was the end of the trail for Bennett Johnson, who's still with us, by the way, at 90 years old.
He spoke to him 2 weeks ago. Sounds great.
All right.
Yeah. Well, Dan, and look, this show's moving on up because you time
yeah,
to get
well,
you a next
it's
guest.
It's always great to visit with Deborah Sternberg, who's had this amazing life beyond Baton Rouge, but comes from a legendary family. And for those of us who revere the old store on Florida Boulevard, every time I drive by there, I want to weep. It no longer is there. It was the largest store in the country, wasn't it?
Built as a department store, yes.
And you grew up there.
I did. I grew up walking the aisles of Gotchaw's.
Did you work there?
Absolutely. Starting at age five.
Five.
We would pick up the bottles, and then we moved up to gift wrap and other. I love to sell. So.
And it just isn't the same. As of course, brick and mortar stores have been hurt immensely by the internet, but. But beyond that, that was a family-owned store that was the largest department store in the country.
That's right.
And your mom and dad are still with us?
Yes.
I need to get your dad back. He wrote that great book, When We Were Merchants. And a listener notes that's more than 30 years ago that you turned the keys of the kingdom over to
92.
Somebody. 92.
And now my father is chairman of a payroll processing company.
And he's
so
doing
he keeps going.
He never stopped. And we wouldn't expect Hans Sternberg to do anything different. Now, Deborah, and we will ask her, I always enjoy getting her take on her association with one Dan Rather. She was his top aide. She was whispering in his ear.
I was his associate producer for breaking news, so all breaking news, elections, and everything that happens in the world, hurricanes and otherwise.
And you got to know him well.
Yes.
And for those who, now there's an example of a guy who had an edge on the air, but for those who knew him off the air, say he was this prince of a fellow.
Amazing. A terrific mentor, terrific person, always looking out for wanting to get the story right. Just an amazing guy. I still read what he publishes, and he's still thriving.
Well, several years ago, about 10, I was in Washington one night, and I happened to be waiting for a cab. This was before Uber, and there waiting in front of me was one Dan Rather.
Mm.
And we had a conversation, but I scared the heck out of him. I think he thought he was going to get mugged again. He turned around, but I said, I've come in peace. And he shook my hand, and I really admired that guy. And at 90 years old, he's still doing
it. He's doing great. Yeah,
he's still doing it. And Deborah is here to talk about the Young Entrepreneurs Academy. But before we go there, I think David in Atlanta has a brief reflection on one Dan Rather. David, good morning, sir.
Yes, I'd like to refer to the 60 Minutes 2 report regarding Bill Burkett and George W. Bush's Air Guard record. I knew Mr. Burkett personally. He was very, very ill. I haven't talked to him in years, but he was a standout great American patriot, and I wouldn't think for a second he would ever submit any fraudulent, false documents to 60 Minutes 2 or Mr. Rather. He had an axe to grind against George W. I admit that. I could talk about that if Jim would let me. But and by the way, I think the University of Utah did a study regarding the authenticity of the documents, and they found it to be correct.
All right. Well, that was the document that got Dan Rather fired from CBS. And you are right that what was in there proved to be true, that George Bush never reported for his guard unit in Alabama. Never reported, by the way. President of the United States, but the document was not proved to be legitimate, and Dan Rather went on his way. And were you with him at that time, or were you gone by then?
I was not his producer at that time, no.
Thank goodness, because there was some collateral damage there that was unfortunate, and Dan was doing too many things. He was doing, that was on a 60 Minutes report,
right.
And he basically was just taking the information provided to him, and he got burned by it.
Yeah, a messy time, for sure.
Those Ratherisms.
Yes.
You've kept them, haven't you?
I do. I need to ship them to him, but there are so many.
Well, it's been several years, but we need to bring Deborah back to talk about Ratherisms. But in our remaining time, I do want to get her in about her baby, and this is a big thing in Louisiana, the Young Entrepreneurs Academy. When did you start?
5 years ago.
5 years ago, and then you had to deal with COVID.
Yes.
But students in grades 8 through 12 in 9 parishes generate business ideas, conduct market research, write business plans, and pitch a panel to investors for seed funding. And then they file their own companies with the Louisiana Secretary of State's office. And you have gotten an amazing response from this, haven't you?
It's tremendous. Every year we accept about 25 students and we receive 50 to 70 applications from high school students interested in launching their own business.
Well, what are some of the most notable ones?
So there's a student who's in the manufacturing prototyping stage on an app that's like Uber for tutors. So if it's 2 a.m. and you're having trouble with math in Baton Rouge and no one's awake, no educators going to tutor you at 2 in the morning, his platform will allow you to connect with someone else in a different time zone to get tutoring.
And now you're getting the gears in motion for the next one.
That's right.
So an application deadline is coming soon.
August 21st. So people can apply online at yeabr.org.
Okay. Once again, that's yeabr.org. And what do they need to do online when they get there?
So students will write a couple of short essays explaining why they're interested in entrepreneurship and launching a business and submit their transcript and a letter of recommendation, and we'll interview every applicant and select the class by the beginning of September.
And how many are in the class?
About 25, 26 students.
And to date, 79 high school students from the greater Baton Rouge area have launched 66 businesses. And I've been honored to be the master of ceremonies a few times, and it is a diverse group.
Yes.
All over the city, different backgrounds.
Multiple parishes. So yeah. We typically have students from four or so parishes, very diverse backgrounds, and it's leveling the playing field with all of these students.
Students graduate with a certificate in entrepreneurship. They're eligible for 3 credits from LSU for this. And in those who meet in the academy, they go on to other endeavors. And I'm sure this association is quite helpful beyond the 3 credits.
Oh, absolutely. And they meet each other, and many end up going to LSU's College of Business. So they create friendships. And then they're also excellent employees. So if they decide that entrepreneurship is hard, because it is, they also understand the fundamentals of business and can be an asset to any business.
I remember Todd Graves was on this show, the Raising Cane's guy, and he said that he presented his business plan at a class at LSU and got a C.
That's right.
Got a C.
That's right.
So you never know, do you?
You never know. I went to high school with Todd. He's an amazing person and tremendous entrepreneur.
Well, and nationwide now.
Yes.
So
globally.
No doubt.
No doubt.
I was in Las Vegas a few years ago, and I turned on the television, and the first spot is for Raising Cane's with Todd Graves. So that shows you how Baton Rouge sometimes is the center of the universe. Now, it's been 5 years, so have you kept track of these?
Absolutely. So we track all of our graduates. We have ongoing programming for our graduates, whether it's, you know, figuring out how to do better marketing or TED Talks, public speaking. We track them and offer continuing ed.
Well, it's once again coming soon. August 21st is the deadline for applicants. Now, as far as the information that is needed to apply, do they have to give a plan when they apply?
No, they do not have to have an idea for a business when they apply, and they'll come up with that idea in the first few weeks of class.
It's the fifth year, 79 students from the greater Baton Rouge area, 9 parishes have launched 66 businesses, and you've kept in touch, and I suspect some of these will be around long after you and I are gone.
That's right. That's the hope.
So once again, the website is
yeabr.org.
yeabr.org. And Deborah, you could be doing a lot of things, but you're doing this. We commend you for doing so, and next time around, we'll talk about what the catalyst was. You have a passion for this, and that's apparent.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Our pleasure. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services and from Jerry Lane Chevrolet. Thanks to Dan Bourdais and Deborah Sternberg and to producer Robin Dow. Until tomorrow, stay safe and stay tuned.